Welcome to Inside, the insurance news podcast hosted by me, Andrew Sawcox. In this week's edition of Inside, we're seasoned experts for your industry news, and our knowledge of insurance is an insult to our competitors. Yes, even our editorial team are becoming habitual punsters. Honey Insurers has some sweet investment news, while underwriting agency Salt shakes up its executive team. You heard it here first. Treasury is considering more standard definitions for natural disasters to benefit insurance customers. At least that's their bay leaf. And the government's flood inquiry continues doing the rounds as fast as its legs will carry them. We've been listening in to see if it's a waste of time. Hello, everyone. This week, I'm joined by fellow punsters, senior journalist Miranda Maxwell, editor John Deeks, deputy editor Wendy Pugh, and chairman Terry McMullen. Good morning, John.
Hello.
Our headlines have been especially spicy this week.
Well, we're trying to compete with you, Andrew. That's the thing.
Hello, Terry.
Good morning, Andrew.
Were you aware, or didn't you have any time to review them?
I can say as you're always, as usual, trying to curry favour.
And welcome back, Miranda.
Thank you, Andrew. Great to be back.
You're kind of a big deal around here.
Am I?
And hello, Wendy.
Good morning, Andrew.
What would you say if I told you many of our listeners tell me you're a nice lady? Perhaps the star.
I wouldn't believe you.
Well, Treasury is consulting on creating more standard definitions for natural disasters, Wendy, and some key submissions are in.
Yeah, ICA and consumer groups are among those who have put in submissions, and they've got a very different take on this matter. So ICA says its members do hold diverse views, but, you know, it raises concerns that if there's too much conformity, that can actually limit competition, and standardising more natural hazard terms isn't enough by itself to improve consumer understanding of insurance. It says it's been working to look at measures so consumers better understand things they can do to reduce risks and mitigation and resilience. And, you know, more standardisation of contracts and terms isn't going to deliver much on its own when it comes to affordability and the protection gap. But consumer groups say, you know, it's time for some action on this. They point out that misunderstanding of policies is leading toward underinsurance and inflated premiums. People don't find it easy to compare or shop around. And, you know, at claims time, they're getting surprised when they don't have the cover they thought they'd signed up for. So, you know, Treasury has suggested standardised definitions for fire, storm and rainwater runoff. And the consumer groups say it should then go further, and definitions around maintenance and wear and tear should be included as well and not left to the industry to sort out.
Well, I feel like I've asked this question many times before. Don't be mean or median, Terry, but do you think it would help to have standard definitions for things like storm and fire?
Well, first off, who's going to set these standard definitions, the insurers or the regulators? That's really the most important question. Underwriters set limits of cover, not regulators, and the limits the insurers set may well be different from the limits set by their competitors. And there are many strategic reasons for doing that. For example, one insurer may be willing to splash easy deals around to get a better or bigger share of the customer base in a particular risk class, while another wants to stick to a more cautious formula for its own reasons. It's called competition. There's this drive by regulators and consumer groups to have standard definitions because they don't actually care about the competition aspects. And you know, really, Andrew, why should they? They don't seem to understand how the competition for risk capital works or how different strategies achieve different results. And then let's really look at the example of the standard definition of flood, which was introduced about 12 years ago after about half a century of bitching and insisting a standard definition of flood wasn't wanted or needed. I mean, the definition that finally emerged for flood has turned out to be every bit as confusing now as it was before, because insurers seem to have taken up differing definitions of what the definitions actually mean. So no, standard definitions sound good, but you'd have to impose such crushing detail that I reckon it'd kill competition. And in doing that, it would remove the incentive to ever lower premiums.
Well, the government's flood inquiry has hit the road, Miranda, and you were listening in to last week's Lismore session.
Yes, I was listening in on Thursday. It was a long day. We heard from politicians and local businesses and not-for-profits, and also quite a few very damning individual stories of difficult claims experiences, which you might expect. One MP said while she wouldn't expect insurers to be Mother Teresa, these were horror stories, and the processes, especially as they stand, and also flood cover affordability, really aren't fit for purpose, in her opinion. While it was very much reiterated that it was the biggest insurance disaster in Australia's history and that the Northern Rivers area was hardest hit, so of course insurers struggled to keep up, it was still hard to listen to these direct stories of hardship from the residents. I mean, one said she'd actually called police because builders refused to give ID and were removing things like antique French doors and other valuable items. She was in tears and said insurance was a scam and destroying people. The committee chairman, Daniel Molino, said the evidence, such as people being bounced around for months and claims still unresolved, was very concerning. He indicated he might recommend strengthening regulation, such as for consent to enter properties, and maybe make individual insurer case transparency stronger to promote accountability. There was also a suggestion hydrologist reports might cover a whole area rather than every separate property needing one. So there's definitely a push to hold insurers more accountable, and customer service of insurers really came under fire. There were accusations of lack of empathy and untrained staff, hours on the phone, and to find the case manager wasn't even in. So I don't know, towns like Lismore are really between a bit of a rock and a hard place, and they do know that. There was talk of government backstops, and a lot of people said, in fact, it is the government who will ultimately pay. So it was really the scale of the disaster that caught everyone under-resourced.
Well, you visited Lismore last year, John. Were you hearing similar horror stories back then?
Yes, I was. So we went along sort of 1 year on from the floods, and I think the thing that really hits you immediately as you walk around the town is these markers they've got for the previous record flood, which was back in 1974 and was about 12 metres high, and you're sort of craning your neck looking up at these markers, and then you realise that the flood in February 2022 was 14.4 metres. So it's another 2 metres and more on top of those markers. So it's quite remarkable, really. You can kind of imagine that the whole town was underwater. So, yeah, people were angry with insurers, either because they were priced out of flood cover or because they experienced delays and problems like Miranda has outlined there. But I think they do also understand that the problem goes way beyond insurance. I spoke to a resident whose home sits on 6 metre high poles, and it still flooded nearly to the ceiling. And she was hoping to sell up as part of the government's buyback program. I also remember driving past a house with a huge banner hanging outside it that just said, "Move me." So, yeah, we know the ICA wants more government money set aside to relocate the most at-risk flood properties. And when you visit Lismore, you can see why.
Well, Wendy, it's had a few tough years, and now New South Wales state insurer iCare is searching for a new CEO.
Yes, Richard Harding will leave in October after leading iCare since 2021. He was appointed when iCare was particularly under fire for its handling of workers' compensation claims and its financial performance. And a predecessor CEO, John Nagle, had resigned after a New South Wales parliamentary committee grilling. So Richard Harding has since led the insurers that's made changes to its claims handling and the way things are being run. And before iCare, he led Tower in New Zealand, and he's had a long career in insurance in Australia. So he says, you know, now's the time for change. He's looking at other ways to use his experience and has recently joined the ANSFAR Australia board. And that sounds like he'll be looking at more of those sorts of roles.
Well, the mainstream newspapers love talking about how much the role is paid, Terry, but iCare is a massive organisation with many challenges.
Yeah, in theory, at least, iCare is Australia's largest insurer, but it bleeds chief executives. Richard Harding is a shrewd and very experienced insurance operator. So what's going on there? I have no real idea. iCare started off well with a terrific cross-section of experienced business people guiding it from the top. And I thought it was a very positive move at the time with some really good people forming it. But I do get the feeling that New South Wales is peculiarly petty politics, call it that, and its rabid radio and its press make it all the more difficult, far more difficult certainly than it should be.
Now, InsurTech Honey is still kicking goals, John, with some major investment news last week.
Yes, that's right. So Honey formed in June 2021 and it's backed by RACQ Insurance. And it's been going pretty well. And this, as you say, last week it announced that it's had a successful funding round of more than $100 million. And it says it's going to use this new firepower to triple revenues, turn profitable, and double headcount to over 200 people. Now, they say they want to be a strong challenger to the local home insurance oligopoly. No, I'm not very clever, but I looked it up and that means an industry that's dominated by just a small number of players. So, yeah, Honey's out to change that. And, you know, they've used technology a lot. They've got one of their selling points is that they send customers little gadgets, sensors that can, you can put them under your sink and they detect if there's a water leak. You can also put them next to windows and doors to see if anyone's breaking in, and you can also put them next to your fire alarms and smoke alarms to, and it'll alert you sort of through your phone if there's any problems. Now, if their customers use these sensors, they get a premium discount, Honey says. So that's certainly one of their selling points. But yeah, they've certainly made an impact on the market, and with this new funding, they could carry on doing so.
What's the secret to their success so far, Miranda?
Well, I think CEO and founder Richard Joffe is quite the asset. I actually was once in a lift with him in Sydney, and he definitely has the gift of the gab and is a very impressive operator. He's created some really unrivaled relationships, and I think that's the key to Honey's success. This has created almost an instant and very impressive customer base for them. So the list of its investors and distribution partners includes some really heavy-hitting names like real estate major McGrath, Bank of Queensland, AGL, Metricon, Afterpay, PEXA, Airtasker. There's a former News Corp Australia and Foxtel CEO as its chairman. You know, some really local names. And as John mentioned, it also gives customers the discounts for installing tech, which is appealing. And I think lastly, the marketing team really works on overdrive. There are lots of really eye-catching images with Barbie pink kitchens and so on social media. So Honey seems to have really hit a sweet spot.
Well, there's another election coming up later this year, Wendy, and a consumer group is trying to push insurance taxes onto the agenda.
Yes, the Queensland state election is due in late October. So the Australian Consumers Insurance Lobby plans to make stamp duty a campaign issue. And it points out that the election could hinge on marginal seats in northern Queensland, and these areas particularly facing high insurance costs that are exacerbated by the 9% stamp duty. So it's putting its case to both sides of politics, and it's reached out to industry organisations to see if it can get more support for a media campaign. So it preferably wants a stamp duty on insurance removed, but alternatively it suggested the funds raised could be directed toward mitigation and resilience spending.
Could this campaign bear fruit, John?
Well, I think it should. You know, we probably don't need to go over all the arguments as to why taxing insurance heavily is daft. I mean, insurance is not a bad thing. We want people to buy it, and we know that underinsurance is a huge problem. And in Queensland especially, as Wendy says, premiums are high. They're much higher than other parts of the country, so the argument there is stronger. And then you think how complicated it was to set up the cyclone reinsurance pool and make some premium savings that way. This would be a lot more straightforward just by axing one tax. You could probably cut premiums by a similar amount. Now, if the consumer groups are able to team up with the likes of ICA and NIBA, it could be quite a powerful message to, as Wendy says, both sides of politics in the run-up to this election. And yeah, if we look at New South Wales, there was some success there with the ESL following that election. And yeah, you could argue that that's a little bit more straightforward, and that to axe the stamp duty, you've then got to revamp taxes more broadly. But, you know, this is certainly one thing that does need to be looked at.
Well, finally, Terry, the latest edition of the Insurance News magazine will be out soon. What can readers expect from this issue?
More action and excitement than you might expect, Andrew. We've dug into the insurance issues around lithium-ion batteries, which is really important for insurance because they have an embarrassing habit of burning houses down. This latest issue also includes an in-depth interview with Lloyd's new regional director, Chris McKinnon, a familiar face around the industry who is soon going to take up a role that will see him forever living on an aeroplane. And we also have write some about his replacements in Australia. We've taken on the gender pay gap in insurance, which is very brave of us, and what's being done about it, and why is it so hard? And we look at the vital role of insurance in the bloodstock industry. We've also spoken to outgoing NIBA Chief Executive Phil Kewin, who's shared his thoughts on the challenges that brokers still face. And we've analysed Vero's latest SME Insurance Index, which is one of the most important documents of the year for brokers. And we look at what our inaugural insurance news conference achieved. That one's a thriller, Andrew. Go us.
Well, that brings us to the end of this week's Insight podcast by Insurance News. Thank you once again to our panel, Miranda Maxwell, Wendy Pugh, John Deeks, and Terry McMullen. Enjoy your week, and thank you all for listening. If you have any questions or comments, please email us at editor@insurancenews.com.au. We value your input. You can read all these stories and many others at your leisure at insurancenews.com.au. You can subscribe to the Insight podcast on iTunes, Spotify, Google, on all your favorite podcast platforms now. We look forward to catching up again next week.